Welcome to the show. I'm James.
I'm Dan.
I'm Riley.
And today we are discussing the 2007, I think, movie There Will Be Blood from director Paul Thomas Anderson. We'll laugh. We'll argue. We might get a little too into it. But at the end of the day, they're just movies.
I'm a spoil man, you see. So this is a spoiler alert.
We're going to do a lot of Plainview accents this show. Next week, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. David should be back after his two-week vacation, and that's one of his favorite movies. But today, it's There Will Be Blood all day. A deceiving title on this one. It's not a horror movie. It's not an action movie.
There was some blood. Happened.
There are some.
I mean, it sets workplace up expectations.
Yeah, there's workplace accidents.
Yeah.
Anyways, what are you giving this movie out of 10?
Definitely like a Kino out of 10. I would say either a 9.8 or a solid perfect 10.
What's a Kino?
What did you first say? Yeah, what was that word?
Kino, Kino out of 10?
The French word for theater?
Yeah.
Or it's movie? It's
movie
those
out of 10.
Those little lottery ticket things that are at your table at the pub?
It's spelled differently. K-I-N-O.
What is the origin of this? What does this mean?
I have absolutely no idea. It was kind of bastardized as a joke term for movies online. If it's Kino, it's like top tier cinema, but you would always rate it.
Oh.
It would be like a really trashy movie that you would rate Kino.
People are using it to say, oh, that's a good movie. That's Kino.
Yes. Now
gotcha.
You get it. Yes.
We're on a movie podcast and
we don't
have
know.
Not heard of this.
Yes. No, that's, so you like it though?
Absolutely. Yeah, right. It's absolutely one of my favorite films, probably one of the better pieces of cinema.
Hell yeah. Take that, Riley.
Whoa.
Do you not like this movie?
He's a PTA hater historically. Anyways,
are we going to fight today?
Well, let's find out. It's your turn, Riley.
It's a horror movie that you might not recognize as a horror movie until it's over. Wow, I guess you were wrong right away, James. Just kidding. I don't know. We'll talk about it. And it's a Paul Thomas Anderson movie that I like. I'm giving it out a 9 out of 10. Mm-hmm. I love this movie. It's my second time watching it. And I felt mostly the same as I did the first time through. In awe, unsettled, analyzing. It's good. It's a good movie. There's lots to it.
Mm-hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you say this is a good movie, you will agree. We did way better impressions off camera before.
Yeah,
lost it now. That's my whole slogan.
It'll come back.
That's the whole slogan. I love it. 9.75. I have seen this many times, and on this watch, I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll like it less this time, now that I'm a connoisseur. But no, there's nothing I would change about it, really.
Really?
I don't think I'd change anything. The score is so dope. Everything.
It's really great.
Yeah, everything is perfect.
So many
it comes
layers
in at the right
to it.
Time. Things are set up and they're knocked down.
I wrote down a surprising amount of notes for this, and they're all just questions. What is that? Yeah, so let's do all that.
What's with the scene where?
Hey, that's the Mario
that's
voice.
For
we're
later.
We're gonna talk about that later. But for now, a message from our sponsors. Thanks to Secret Lab for sponsoring this video. Secret Lab chairs are designed to keep you comfortable for those long nights of work and play. Their Titan Evo 2022 series chair offers four-way lumbar support. It comes with a magnetic memory foam head pillow and is offered in different upholsteries like hybrid leatherette, soft weave fabric, and Nappa leather. Actually, a leather that was very popular in 1898.
Oh.
So, yeah, during the... Yeah,
they mined it.
I made that up. Best of all, a 5-year extended warranty is included along with a 49-day return policy, so you're covered if anything goes wrong. Learn more about Secret Lab at lmg.gg/secretlabtjm.
Secret Kingdom. In the
Sisterhood
lab.
Of the Traveling Lab. Thanks to Manscaped for sponsoring today's video. Manscaped's Lawnmower 4.0 is designed to keep your family jewels safe with their ceramic blades featuring skin-safe tech to reduce nicks and cuts. We don't want those nicks and cuts. Reduce them. Leave the cables at home with its new wireless charging system that is compatible with most Qi charging pads. Your Apple Watch.
Wow.
It's cordless. Waterproof.
Apple Watch.
Is that Qi charging?
No, it's not.
I don't even... I'm a Pixel man. It's cordless, waterproofing, gets 90 minutes of use on a full charge. So head to manscaped.com/TJM20 and get 20% off and free shipping today.
Some great quotes. Great quotes.
Drainage!
I've abandoned my child! Yeah. I've abandoned my child!
Boy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I say that so much. Yeah, that one stuck with me for years now.
There actually are some quotes that I say all the time from this movie that are just very random, but... Anyways, what
I thought
in
you
this
didn't
movie?
Have a child, but it turns out you've abandoned them.
Yes. As one does.
In this movie, in 1898 New Mexico, prospector Daniel Plainview breaks his leg while mining but manages to find silver. By 1902, he's discovered oil near Los Angeles and built a mining company. One of his workers dies in an accident, and Daniel adopts the man's orphaned son, H.W. In 1911, a young man named Paul Sunday tips Daniel off to an oil deposit under his family's property in Little Boston, California. Daniel pays Paul and visits the property, offering to buy it under the ruse of using it to hunt quail. But Paul's identical twin brother Eli knows of the oil and demands $10,000 to build a church. Daniel agrees to pay half up front and also buys up all the surrounding land except for a tract owned by one holdout, William Bandy. When the derrick is built, Eli asks to bless it. Daniel initially agrees, but later refuses. After the drilling begins, an accident kills one worker and another, deafens HW, and destroys the derrick. Another accident, that is. When Eli blames the incidents on the well not being blessed and demands the money he's owed, Daniel beats and humiliates him. When Daniel hires a man claiming to be his half-brother Henry, a jealous HW tries to kill him, so Daniel sends the boy off to a school for the deaf. Daniel then begins work on a pipeline to the California coast, only to be reminded that he still doesn't own the Bandy Tract. He and Henry travel there, but Daniel grows suspicious of Henry's story, and after learning that this man was an imposter lying to get a job, Daniel murders him in a rage. The next morning, he's woken by William Bandy, who agrees to let the pipeline run through his land if Daniel publicly repents for his sin in Eli's church. During his baptism, Eli coerces Daniel into confessing that he abandoned his child! In 1927, this is a time jump now, Daniel is a wealthy alcoholic living alone in a huge mansion. When HW says he wants to establish his own drilling company in Mexico, Daniel mocks his deafness and reveals he's just a bastard from a basket! Very funny. HW replies that he's glad they're not related and walks out to more jeers. Eli, in need of funds, meets Daniel in his private bowling alley and offers to sell him the Bandy Tract. Daniel agrees if Eli will declare that he is a false prophet and God is a superstition. After Eli acquiesces, Daniel reveals the property is now worthless due to milkshake drainage. That's what I wrote. Daniel taunts Eli before chasing him around the bowling alley and beating him to death with a bowling pin. When his butler comes to check on him, Daniel announces, "I'm finished." And that's the end of the movie. And you're seeing the monster in his lair, having just achieved his kill. It's a great ending.
We finally got our blood.
Well,
sets up expectations and delivers on
it. It's true. You have to wait a while.
It's quite a lot of blood. I always wonder what the butler guy is thinking. Like, can you see it from back there? Like,
I'm going to have to clean this out of the bowling
out of the
lane.
It's got gutters.
I'm going to have to re-wax this.
I mean, there's a lot of blood throughout the movie. Many people die, but I think that the blood actually refers to the oil. Are we agreeing on this?
I don't know. The book from which it's adapted is called Oil, with an exclamation mark at the end. I love when titles have punctuation. Like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Our last episode. Wait, is there a comma in there?
Comma. Yeah,
not sure.
Yeah. Oh Brother, comma.
Oh.
Oh. Yeah. Was it a well-known book, or was it more of an obscure one? Something I was reading made it sound like he just like found it in a random library, and it wasn't that big of a book or something.
I have no idea. Can't speak to that.
I think, Paul Thomas Anderson found this book, and then he started like researching this time period, and it was like very interesting to him, this like early prospecting, like finding out about oil and how to extract it and all this stuff. And I think that's how he started writing it, from what I hear.
There's a lot of really interesting, like, oligopolies and monopoly and like, horrible, horrible capitalistic behavior.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, this movie really does sort of pivot around,
It's
right?
a good stage for this kind of character because psychopaths are overrepresented in the CEO community.
Yes.
It's true.
And he's totally...
Especially oil CEOs.
Tycoons,
you could say.
You got to be a...
Roller coaster tycoons.
But yes. I think the strength of this movie, the biggest thing, has got to be the acting. Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh my God, yeah.
The best ever. I think he has like 4 Best Actor awards at this point. Maybe more.
For this movie?
You got all 4 on this one.
It's always a hard thing for me watching a movie like this because I know that there are some deep thematic things going on. And there's lots of analysis to be had with it. But at the same time, I know that on another level, it's almost more entertaining to just kind of forget all about that and just like watch Daniel Day-Lewis play this character.
DDL. Me and my friends call him DDL.
Yeah, DDL. This absolute psychopath play like this character who is just like going through life caring about no one except himself.
Well, I think it's a little more nuanced than that because I would argue that the main relationship in this movie is actually just taking a step back. A lot of people get focused on Like they're kind of the save the cat way of thinking about a movie script about, you know, the inciting action. And then now we're in act 2 and the world will never be the same. And how are they going to overcome this? But Craig Mazin, who is the writer of the, well, he did some Hangover movies and then he did the Last of Us is what he's working on now.
Oh.
And he also did, Chernobyl. Not anyways, he has a podcast with, John August, and his main thing of thinking about a story is by what's the main relationship. That's like question number one.
Mm, yeah.
And I always kind of thought that the main relationship in this was Eli and Daniel.
Oh, but absolutely.
I don't think so anymore. On this watch, I think it's HW and Daniel.
No.
Mm.
I wouldn't say so as much. I think HW is there to maybe explain more about Daniel, but it's definitely, I think from this viewing, I really got evil capitalist man and religious man are the same person.
Okay.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite interesting. But I would certainly say that HW is there more of like a character foundational pawn for Daniel, both literally and figuratively.
The way I was looking at it was like, if you think of his, it's like a rags to riches to rags story, right? It's a tragedy. It all turns when HW gets sent away to school.
Yeah, that was really bad.
That's when he really unravels.
Yeah.
Because it kind of seems for a while there that he's maybe going to make a go of it. Like HW comes back and he's spending time with them. But then they have the scene where he's drunk at getting an expensive meal. And then the Standard Oil guys are there again. And he makes a fool of himself again with HW there. And that's like from then on out, it's all downhill. And he just deteriorates.
I think the turning point for him was when HW gets sent away to deaf school, and then he meets with the Standard Oil guys, and he's obviously a bit shaken from losing HW. I think he probably cared about him in some regard.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I mean, he was obviously a tool.
That's why I would push back on Riley's characterization of him as an absolute psychopath, because I think the tensions in the movie is that he seems to care about HW a bit, just not as much as he cares about
last thread.
This was all
that was holding him together.
This is what was so interesting to me on this rewatch as well, like noticing how he treats HW throughout the movie. Because the first time you watch it, you're not sure about his character, right? You know that he is ruthless. You know that he's like a shrewd businessman and he's manipulative and he's trying to get what he wants, but you don't know the extent of his depravity until the end of the movie. And now on the rewatch, I'm watching through to see, I'm like, is there something there? Is there some shred of like real feeling for his adoptive son? And at the end of it, I think I came to the conclusion that he might be sort of convinced that he feels something for HW, but he doesn't actually. He's only interested in HW insofar as HW is of benefit to him.
But we don't know that.
As soon as HW is not a benefit to him, he would not show that type of love. Like at the end, when he sends HW away, he's walking away and he's like, bastard in a basket. And it cuts back.
Yeah, we get a flashback.
We get a flashback to him, them like playing around and having fun and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, wow. So there was a relationship there. But there was only a relationship when he was useful to Daniel.
Yeah.
As soon as HW showed some independence, as soon as HW became a block in any
that
way.
That makes you my competitor.
He sends him away. He gets him out of there. He doesn't even you know, and you can make arguments, okay, he should have support, he should have, like, you know, resources available to someone who's deaf, like, but that's not why he was sending him away. He's sending him away because Henry showed up, and now he's like, oh, I have real blood connection. Like, they're having that conversation with him and Henry, and he's like, he's talking about himself and how he's like, oh, I hate people, and, you know, my hatred grows up little by little, and blah, 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 and he's like, and Henry's like, I don't feel that way at all. And he's like, well, if it's in me, it's in you. And he's like excited by the prospect of having this other person who is of his blood.
Well, it's hard to find
HW.
Good help.
And HW is not his blood, so he knows that he has none of that in him.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought in that ending flashback, we actually got some scenes of him like beating HW over the back of the head.
The roughhousing a bit, but
I think it was...
That's how he shows affection.
I think it was playful. I actually was like, well, that was kind of rough. But at the same time, it was like they were smiling, and he kind of HW came back and like kicked toward him at the end. It seemed mostly like
yesterday I was on the like BC ferry swinging my little 1-year-old by his ankles. These other parents
over
were like, "Wow, no, God, no, Michael Jackson style." Now, one of the strengths of this movie, though, is the sense of kind of confusion you're in as the audience member, right? Like, take HW. We know off the bat that it's not his kid, right? Mm-hmm. But we see that he takes him. He takes the baby. That's no small feat. He could have just peaced out. I think that, yeah, he saw the ability to use this baby face as a way to, you know, get more clients or whatever, but that's a net negative, especially at the beginning. Like, it's hard to take care of a kid.
I think he definitely gets worse over the years.
Yeah, to the point of like the audience confusion is, so we know that he takes the kid. We know that he's lying to people about the kid, right? He said, mm-hmm. This is my son. Well, what happened to his mother? Oh, she died. Like, he doesn't, and maybe that was not a lie, she did die or whatever, but he's obviously bending the truth to make it seem like this is his kid. But we don't know. So we know the shady stuff happening. We don't know the extent of it. We don't know, is it he only likes HW insofar as he can profit from him, or is it 50-50, or is it 75-25? Well, we don't know. Then we have to keep adjusting as the movie goes on.
I think that's why I describe him as a psychopath, because it appears as if he will be friendly with people, you know, and he will have positive sentiment towards them if they serve a purpose to him. He likes Henry until he finds out that he is not his blood. And even though he could be of use to him, his rage overtakes any sort of positive feelings that he would have. So like this is the sign. I mean, I don't have the DSM in front of me. I don't know like the actual list of like psychopathy traits or requirements, but the fact that he like may show some outward love towards HW or Henry or some other people that he like is in business with, is sort of inconsequential when the most important things to him are his narcissism and his rage and his greed. So like, that will always outweigh for him any positive emotion that he feels towards
him. One more note on this like sense of confusion thing. The fact that they use the same actor, Paul Dano, as Eli and Paul. I think on the first watch, you keep wondering, were there brothers or is this the same guy?
Yeah.
It's pretty clear like there were brothers. But so why did they choose to make Paul the same actor? Why did they choose to make them like identical twins? It's just like another thing to think about when you're watching it.
I think there was that moment for the audience when we first meet Eli, and it's like, okay, well, is this Paul?
Yeah.
Is he pretending?
Yeah.
And then you're kind of in, I think, Daniel's shoes where he's going to now lie to Eli's father. And he's like, okay, well, I've got maybe Paul sitting there. Like, how...
There's so many layers to that scene.
How brutal I go with this guy? And I'm like, I'm trying to empathize with Daniel and be like, well, I, as an audience member, don't know if they really are twins. And like, he's looking at him and he's looking at HW and he's like trying to make that call of how for the throat he goes.
Yeah, that's such an awesome scene. He starts off by like with the blocking. He's just trying to talk to the father, and like Eli's over his shoulder back there, like, you're not really in the conversation. I expected you to get up and leave when I tried to clear the room there, right? Yes. And he's totally trying to trick Abel, right? He's saying, oh, I just happen to be in the area and I like this farm and I want to grow vegetables like you are.
And if that was Paul, he would know that that's absolutely not true.
And then he discovers over the course of the conversation that Eli knows as much as Paul. And Eli's sitting there discovering, like, Daniel's actually pretty bad at this. He kind of reveals that he knows so much about oil very readily. And then Eli's just like, okay, you're obviously a speculator and oil man. Right away. Eli even makes a comment after he asks a question that Daniel doesn't give an answer to. He goes, oh, something you don't know. Yeah, hinting at the fact that you knew everything else about oil. So, like, you're obviously lying to us.
Yeah, I like that, even if it is just put in there as sort of an extra little thing for the audience to think about, it makes things more interesting. You know, that's cool. But I feel like the reason why there's the same actor playing the two roles, and why we have Paul in the beginning getting the $10,000 and Eli at the end constantly trying to get that the second half of the promise 5K. At the end, I feel like it's there to kind of like illustrate the difference in philosophy there. Like, Paul was like, I'm going to... Paul went the Daniel Plainview route. And at the end, Daniel even says, like, Paul has three wells producing. You know, he's got his own little business running. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you should have done what Paul did. Instead, you're doing this stupid religion stuff, and now you want $5,000.
Yeah, I mean, we could get down into like layer 4 or 5 of the movie and think of Paul and Eli as like two directions that their life could have gone. Mm-hmm. Either you follow the path of religion, mm-hmm. And end up dead in a bowling alley with no milkshakes, or you go the Paul route and get into capitalism and be horrible to your entire family, yeah, but you're not dead in a bowling alley.
But you are all alone, alcoholic, shooting things in an empty mansion, you know?
Exactly.
Like, I thought that was such an interesting cut with when they do the time jump. Mm. It shows H.W. and I forget what his wife's name is.
I have it
the daughter.
Yeah. But it's a Sunday daughter, right?
Yeah, the Sunday daughter. They're getting married. And then from the wedding, it cuts right to him shooting at the stuff in his mansion.
Oh, yeah. All and the furniture like, stacked up in the hallway.
Yeah.
It was a really like, nice cut, that time jump.
To the wedding, you mean?
The little girl, and then you see her as an adult. You're like, you just instantly get it.
Well, you understand, yeah.
I appreciated
great.
That.
Very good.
But I loved that the next, like, it cuts from the wedding to that scene of the shooting in the hallway, because it's just like, it shows you immediately, you immediately get the sense that, like, what was all this for? Like, why were you...
Well, that's another part of the turn.
Manipulating people, yeah.
Is HW goes away, and Plainview gets offered, like, $1 million... Because he said to Henry earlier, like, yeah, I want to build this big house. I want to be able to get away.
Yeah.
But no, you don't. You want to just keep working.
Yeah.
That's what you really want, is just to continue collecting and growing and spreading
I don't think it's even that. I think that he basically gets what he wants in the end. He's all alone. He's alone in his house, you know, with all of this stuff and this amazing mansion. He built up all this money and he got exactly what he wanted. Now he's alone and alcoholic and depressed. And all he has to comfort him is his rage.
But he's
and
still working.
Occasionally,
though.
Someone else wanders in, and he can murder them with a bowling pin.
But he's not retired.
Well, yeah, but he's still like, if you see him, he's just signing stuff. He's not like working, you know. He's not like out there doing stuff.
That's what it's like at the top, baby.
Exactly. Mm. Wow, what a model to emulate. Nice job, Daniel.
Thank you.
Oh, Bessie. First 50 minutes of this movie, no dialogue at all.
The mm-hmm. pacing is really interesting. Yeah, it kind of does this, but in the perfect kind of...
You're making like an undulating motion with your hands.
Yeah, it kind of goes slow and gets a bit more intense, and then it drops off, and I think it's paced really well. There's no dialogue at the beginning, but we get just so much exposition.
You get so much characterization, though, right? Like,
yeah.
Man.
Because he's working so hard, and he breaks his leg, and he goes all the way there. He drags himself just so he can sell his mm-hmm. silver. And we understand
but
so much about
not
him.
Only just that, because yeah. like not only do we know that he's a survivor because he pulls himself out of this well, mm-hmm. nobody was going to find him.
No.
And then just the excruciating pain. Like, I've had a bum leg before. Some people know I was stabbed in the leg at one point.
Oh, right.
And it healed in a couple of days. But like that first day, like I couldn't even like shift in my bed, right? So he was feeling that probably times 10 because he probably broke his femur or something. Got himself up a ladder. And then I love the shot that just tilts up over the landscape. Like, he's got to go all those miles.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
And the ground, man. He's pushing himself along the ground. Like, his whole body would be so scraped. It'd be awful.
Yeah.
But with all of that survival to have to do, in the moment where he needs to just fight for his life, before he leaves, he goes and checks the result of the blast that he had. Did I strike oil or not? He inspects, like, the charcoal or whatever it is. What would that be? Coal? I don't know what it is.
Dirt? Rock?
He looks at it.
Mm. Earth?
Because he's still so obsessed with, like, did I strike anything?
Yeah.
And then he goes and saves himself. It's just...
I love that that's how we're introduced to him, because when you're watching it for the first time, maybe you've seen a trailer, I don't know, depending on how much you know about the movie, you may, in fact, think that he is our protagonist that we are going to cheer for. I mean,
he
is the protagonist. But you may, in fact, like, at that point, you don't know that he's the, like, this is a story about a villain, really. Like, he's the protagonist, but he's not a hero. He is a villain. And at that point, you're, like, respecting him. You're like, man, yeah, wow, the strength of will, the motivation, the resolve to, like, just push through this pain and, like, determination. He's out there. I don't know if it's indicating that he dug that hole. It seems like it's an existing hole. But at the very least, he's in there all by himself, just, like, going away for hours and hours, days, probably.
Pull yourself from your bootstraps kind
exactly.
of guy.
Exactly. And I think it's implied that he doesn't start from wealth or anything. He's like from this small town, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's like, yeah, it's a very much a pull yourself up by your bootstraps thing. And so, yeah, it's only over the course of the movie that we start to learn. The more that happens, you're like, this guy might be a devil.
Well, yeah, a lot of you can tell in his sales techniques as well when he's doing the monologues to these different towns. He emphasizes the things they're going to get from his operation or enterprise that are true things, like the education. Mm-hmm. You know, he always goes back to, I'm going to blow gold all over these hills.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also puts in things that don't need to be there that are just manipulating people to his side. Like he emphasizes in all of his sales pitches, like a ticking clock. Like, this is an exploding offer. Someone else is going to drain it. Someone else is going to get here.
They don't have the skills that I do.
I can start drilling in 10 days. And he puts like this time pressure
I'm
on it.
I'm there with my men and my equipment.
Exactly.
We can start drilling in 10 days.
I'm making my business to be there, to see their work. Fuck, I love it.
Yeah,
you can tell me and my friends who quote this movie all the time for no reason. This is like the get back from the bar at 2 in the morning and you're already a bliss and you're like, you know what, before we go to bed, let's just watch the I'm an oil man monologue. Why not?
It's the monologues are phenomenal. The dialogue's phenomenal. It's got a lot of really ridiculous quotable lines taken out of context, don't make any sense. In context, they're absolutely disgusting and horrible. And I think that's what makes it's kind of like almost a comedy, in the sense that if you can't laugh, then you're going to start crying.
There definitely are some times where like things kind of seem so over the top that you almost want to laugh, but it's like, I was thinking actually recently about how like laughter and horror are like really close. It's it's like they're emotional reactions that can kind of turn easily into the other. If you're watching someone get horribly, horribly beaten, at a certain point, you're like, this is ridiculous. Oh, this is funny. You know, it's like, but because it's a movie, if you were watching in real life, it would be different. But
yes, yeah.
Like getting slapped around in the mud and stuff.
Yeah.
At some point, it is horrifying, but at some point, you're just kind of like, wow, he's really going at him.
Yeah. And then Eli slaps him back later.
I was going to say, yeah, he's like, parallel that. And so this is why I was thinking, you know, it's got this capitalism and this religion thing where, you know, Daniel uses his wealth and power to be able to slap Eli around. And then Eli exercises his control over the church to put Daniel in a weak position and slaps him around. So they both kind of get at each other with different types of weapons. Almost,
and they're in each of each other's territories, right?
Exactly.
They're in my building now with my congregation.
And
I can slap
Eli is all powerful there and, you know, not elsewhere.
Yeah.
But that's a tiny little locust of control compared to Daniel's, like, the entire U.S., oil supply kind of thing.
I love how the way that they react or interact with each other kind of changes from scene to scene. Like in the beginning, they're both kind of trying to bluff each other.
They're very quiet and reserved.
Yeah. Like when they're trying to make the deal. Mm-hmm. And then later when the oil derrick is
the
built,
blessing.
Eli asks for the blessing and they are still sort of bluffing.
I like all religions, you know, I'm being a manipulative
person. Yeah, and he placates him, right? He's like, you can do the blessing, no problem.
Whatever.
But it's also
thanks.
Like,
yeah, goodbye.
Yeah, it's like he's not, it's almost like he just like says whatever he needs to say to get Eli out of there. It's Eli is saying is completely inconsequential.
He could have let Eli bless the well. And it's like, why didn't he? I think for his own ego and wanting to be associated so strongly with the Derek.
Well, I didn't think he was going to remember what Eli told him to say or what Eli was going to say, but Daniel uses that.
So the proud daughter of these hills.
F-U right to him who is standing snap dab in the middle of the congregation.
It's like, you shouldn't have given me this little phrase and now I'm going to use it and have people remember that I said it.
Congregation.
And I know you know that I know.
Yeah.
And you're not going to react to it because that would look bad socially.
And he embarrasses Eli he has his whole congregation there.
Everyone else leaves.
They were expecting, he probably told them, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to bless it and then we'll sing a hymn. Yeah. So they're all like, well, what was the plan,
so
man?
Excited. Right. We have a well. We have all this money that's going to come in. And
another thing that kind of characterizes him as being calculating is when he gives the I'm an oil man speech to that town and the townspeople are all in a ruckus, he pulls out of that deal.
Yeah.
I thought he was bluffing there. He's walking away being really like, oh, too much confusion. I don't want it. I thought he was just going to use that to come back and counteroffer. But he really means that. He doesn't want it. And so what that implies to me is he's looking for the right town, the right victim. He needs the town to be in a certain shape so that he can really extort as much as he can from it.
He's a predator.
They need him.
Yeah.
Yeah, freaking little Boston has fuck all.
Absolutely nothing.
Exactly.
Doesn't even have
nothing.
Water.
They got goats.
Yeah. They don't even have potatoes.
We'll build roads. Yeah. To go back to the Daniel and Eli thing.
Sorry, they do have potatoes.
I'm sorry, guys. The next scene after that whole blessing thing is when Daniel comes and visits the church, and Eli just got finished, like, you know, excising
doing the show
demon out
Eli's
of somebody.
Been so reserved the whole time.
Yeah,
and then you see him
in his element,
in a Daniel style rage.
Yeah,
and the performance is phenomenal. Yeah. He's talking about excising that demon.
One goddamn hell of a show.
Get out of here, ghost! And and then. So then we flip back and we see Daniel there. It's actually kind of funny because, like,
it's like respects the man.
The POV, the camera is like backing up from Eli as he pushes the ghost out of the church. And then the camera just flips back and we see Daniel right there. And it's like, oh, Daniel's the devil. But anyways, Daniel.
Oh, I didn't think of that.
Daniel.
Oh, yeah, that went over my head too. Yeah, I like that.
So in that scene right after that, Daniel and Eli are talking. I forget what that conversation's about. But I noted during that conversation that Daniel was talking to Eli as if they're both onto each other because they're both fakers, right? They both are manipulative. They don't really believe what they're doing.
Well, Daniel obviously thinks that of Eli because he doesn't respect, because that's why he says to Eli, that was one goddamn hell of a show.
Yeah,
those are all
exactly,
curse words.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. And Eli knows that Daniel, you know, what he really cares about is money and success. And it's like, he's not actually caring about the town or anything. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like Daniel knows that they're both fakers. They both know that they're both fakers, but Daniel in that scene is acting as if they both know. And Eli is still trying to like act as if they're still playing their roles. And he's like, yes, Daniel. He's like acting like a preacher instead of, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to talk to you plainly. Yeah. But then in the end scene, this is the final thought I have on this thing and how they interact. In the end, Eli's coming in and he's like, hey, Daniel, my old friend, you know, like, hey, you know, it's
I'm
been a long time.
Whiskey.
We're drinking together. You know, I'm making a business proposition. Hey, it's all good or whatever. And Daniel just is like instead of seeing themselves as sort of like equals in what they're doing.
They're in different businesses.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They're both on top of their game.
Right.
Right.
And in the end, Daniel is just like complete disdain.
Well, he had to get him back.
Yeah.
Because Eli previously got to do the whole, like, I've abandoned my child scene. It was time for final retribution on that.
Mm-hmm. I just like, as you've said, Dan, I really loved how the movie takes, like, two people who are faking it and, like, puts forward kind of, like, two paths for, like, what this would look like.
And they,
like,
but they both believe in their own gods so strongly.
Well, so do you think Eli actually believes... Is he actually like a spiritual person or is...
I think he actually is.
Yeah, for sure.
Just how Daniel loves money and business, right? I mean, it's a difficult parallel to actually make, but I actually do think that Eli believes in what he's talking about. Obviously, he feels that Daniel's putting his faith in false prophets, the goal of success and sinning and all that sort of stuff, and... Daniel thinks the same of him. I think it's easier for us to empathize.
I don't know.
Yeah,
because,
I don't know.
Because Daniel gets... They both make each other proclaim something, right? Eli says he bears out Daniel's greatest vulnerability to the whole congregation when he tells him, you know, I've abandoned my child, that whole part.
Yeah.
And so Daniel's revenge on that is going to get him to profess something that maybe if Eli doesn't believe it in his heart of hearts... Daniel believes that Eli believes it in his heart of hearts, that he is a faker. And so he gets him to yell it out many times.
Yeah.
I feel like his faith has probably been shaken at that point. He's destitute and he's coming for money. And
exactly.
I agree with you there. Yeah. Certainly.
I feel like
maybe it changes throughout the movie.
Yeah, maybe. I think I'm mostly on board. I'm mostly on board with what you're saying about Eli. Like, I feel like he probably believes on some level, but I think that...
You have to have some doubts at some point.
Well, for sure,
I'm just thinking about when he interacts with Abel, he says things like, God doesn't save stupid men. Like, he's still obviously a religious person.
Yeah, Daniel has his shift where he turns evil, and then Eli kind of goes a bit like, stupid people don't deserve saving, and...
Yeah, he says that to the congregation as well, that not everyone can be saved, which is definitely going to be its own sect, right?
Yeah,
they're Calvinists for sure. just a reference for people who know what that is. I don't know about Daniel like having belief or faith in like money or the greed or whatever. I feel like for him, it's literally just rage and greed and narcissism. Like, I don't know if he like has values per se. I think that he just wants something on like a primal level, and like a like an animal, he just goes for it.
It's a proxy for me demonstrating I'm better than you. What, and it just so happens to be wealth in our society.
Yeah, but I don't even like. But he never wants to. He never demonstrates like a flaunting of his wealth. Really, like he never like shows disdain for poor people. He never is like, oh, that, you know. He never indicates that money is anything but a tool to allow him to get so wealthy that he can from these people, as he calls them. Like, I don't think he really like. I think he's a solipsist almost. He's like, the only thing that exists is me.
He has one line where he indicates materialism, where he says he loves that house. I wanted to live in it and clean it.
Right.
That's when he was a child.
Right.
And he outgrew that. I think in that scene, I can't remember that scene too perfectly, but I think when I was a child, I wanted to live in that. I wanted to clean it. I wanted to eat dinner in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And at one point I wanted to have kids in it or something like that. And I think as he grew up, he just sort of was pursuing being alone.
Yeah.
And money was the factor that allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
Right?
So I guess I would argue that Eli has a philosophy. Eli has a theology. He's like, God exists, and this is how it works in the world, and this is what is good, and this is what is wrong, and blah, blah, blah. And Daniel doesn't have a philosophy. Daniel is, I mean, if he has a philosophy, it's like objectivism, basically, like Atlas Shrugged, where it's just like the only thing that matters is you and your ability to succeed, and everyone trying to keep you down is what I'm
saying, because he says, I hate to see other people succeed. Mm-hmm, and the way that we succeed or don't succeed in this world, the world that he lives in, is through wealth, right?
This whole movie seems very Ayn Rand-y. If you guys have read that, it's basically just the story of someone like Daniel Plainview, but it's about railroads instead of oil, and he's like, you know, is a man not entitled to the sweat of his brow, basically? Wait, is that from the communist thing, or is that from Atlas Shrugged? I always forget. Anyways, he's entitled to the sweat of his brow.
Ayn Rand.
They go full circle, right?
There's a quote here when they get drunk together, him and his not brother. I want to earn enough money I can get away from everyone. Mm-hmm. He really kind of leans into, because there's a man, he's my ilk. Yeah. He's got my blood, and kind of opens up to him about his more deeper personality traits that I don't think he's shared with anyone before.
Oh my gosh.
I see the worst in people.
I don't
need to look past seeing them. Yeah. That's all I need.
I'm slightly embarrassed now, but now I understand why. The quote is from Bioshock.
Oh, good God. Of course it is.
It's from Andrew Ryan, the objectivist. Like that game is heavily inspired by Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, yeah.
And he says that about, you know, is a man not entitled to the sweat of his brow? No, says the man in Washington. It belongs to the poor, which is, you know, that's ridiculous. So now I know that's a Bioshock quote.
Another psychopath element that he exhibits.
I've played Bioshock, by the way. Great game. Continue, man. James.
He takes risks. Like, it's such a risk to listen to Paul, to give Paul the money and then to just pack up and go and survey this town that's far away. Mm. That's a huge risk.
Alone.
With HW.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Going camping.
I mean, he took his gun and his other property, I guess. But no, that is a huge risk, especially as it seems to be in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
But I think at that point he's successful enough to be able to take those kind of trips and, you know, like survey and stuff. Like if he didn't end up being able to buy the stuff, then he'd be like, well, that's a lost.
He still does it on his own though. He could have sent somebody else, but he doesn't do that.
He doesn't trust anybody else.
I don't think he was successful enough at that point. Like, he had made it. He was going to be comfortable.
Because he has like his Coyote Hills thing already drilling. I think he has
a couple drums.
He's got like three going at that point.
But he also doesn't want someone else to make the deal, right? Like, he needs to talk to them himself and manipulate them himself, you know?
Yes.
Why were the Sunday family so desperate to please him when he showed up?
This is my next note. How does his arrangement with the work, with the camping work? Like, you show up and it's almost like it's assumed that it's a bread and breakfast. Like, do you have this? No, but we have this. That'll be fine. Like,
right.
Are you paying them? Or is this just like hospitality?
I feel like this is probably a cultural thing that we're missing because it's so long ago.
It might be that they're incredibly destitute, and it's like this out-of-towner who probably has money has come in. Maybe he will give us some
money. Right, right. That might be
if
it.
If we shower him with hospitality.
Goat's yeah. They're,
but no bread.
They're seeing
I'm
him.
Sorry, we don't have bread.
Yeah, he apologizes. I'm sorry we don't have bread.
He was really upset about that. There's certainly some strange behavior that...
But they don't talk about a price. It's not like Plainview walks up and they're like, yeah, it's $10 a night or something like that. Mm-hmm.
I think it's like
10 cents a night.
It's a class divide that we find hard to understand now because he shows up, he's clearly wealthy.
He's there for leisure.
He's got he's taken time off to go hunt quail. Yeah,
you don't get leisure in the 1900s.
Vacations aren't a thing. So he shows up and he's being, you know, leisurely, and they're like, if we're really nice to him, then he'll give us a little something. Give us a little tip. Mm-hmm.
So weird. Imagine your family just assembling on the edge of your property in a line.
We have visitors, daughters.
Well, and that's the funniest thing, because they didn't know that he's coming, but he shows up and they act as if they were expecting him almost, like the hospitality is there. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's also another thing, like, you know, I don't know if it was as big in those times, but certainly before that, you know, a stranger shows up and A, it could be dangerous, but B, you know, it could also be an opportunity for you to show your hospitality and like make a friend. And, you know, it's like people are wandering around between these far flung settlements.
Yeah, the territory is similarly sized to bears.
The territory?
People, yeah.
What?
Yeah, multiple acres. I feel like I misheard
you,
right?
No, you didn't. But I'm referencing.
The territory is similar.
Early humans were, they are occupied territory in a similar density to bears.
Oh, I see what you're saying. But yes. Okay. Gotcha.
Like 12 people in that town. And it's the entirety of California.
Exactly. If somebody shows up, it's like, whoa, something interesting just happened.
It's a different person.
I'm staring at another a human instead of fields.
Yes.
This is great. Let's hang out.
I wonder if there was some of that as well.
What did you. Going away from thematic things, I guess, for a second. How'd you like his actual performance, like his voice and all this stuff, how he carries himself?
Great.
Daniel Day-Lewis, I mean, obviously.
I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Really. I feel like at a certain point, around midway or a third of the way into the movie, I'm like, this starts to seem kind of cartoony because no one else is talking like this. Like, he talks like this and he very clearly enunciates everything that he's saying. And everyone else is just like, yeah, we can do that for you.
Yeah.
It's just like, why are you talking like that, dude?
I had some goat's milk. Okay, goat's milk.
Yeah.
He's
like, yeah.
Where's he from
again?
There's
oil over there.
Somewhere.
Fond du Lac? What state was that?
Fond du Lac, yeah. I don't.
Because he's in California now, so it's far away.
I can't remember. I don't know if it.
Kansas or something? I
don't know. Yeah. I don't know if he's educated or if he's learned
Lake
to put on
Athabasca.
That voice, because we don't hear him before he's an oil man.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what the heck? Right? It's in Saskatchewan.
Sounds
made up. It's got to be.
Or there's a different one.
That's got to be a different one.
Anyways, at a certain point, I was kind of like, this is interesting that he decided to do this when most other people that almost everybody else that we meet talks like pretty normally. Mm-hmm. And here's Daniel Day-Lewis being like, I'm a acclaimed actor and I had to do a voice for this. I couldn't talk normally. Like,
the only part of it that it's not the accent that calls my attention. It's just the graveliness of it. Like people that are just like, I've been drinking whiskey. Been drinking whiskey since I was 8 years old.
But that was the other thing that struck me about his voice is that it doesn't, like, you would expect someone who talks in that manner to have more like bass or baritone. But his voice seems like kind of similar to mine. Like I'm doing an impression of him because if I was someone else with a deeper voice, it would it would be down here or something, you know, like it. I would expect him to have more rumbly stuff, but it's like he wants to go down and he doesn't quite get down to the very bottom. So then he loses power as he goes down. It's more of a whispery type thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought that was, it works. Like, I feel like his performance is so compelling despite like little nitpicks that I have about the voice. So that's fine. But I think it was, there are times when that kind of pulled me out a little bit because I saw very clearly this actor trying to give this like Oscar winning thing.
No, you know? Not me. DDL works on me. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
It didn't bother me. And now I think it does. I think you've ruined the movie.
Thanks, asshole.
Oh, no.
I'm never going to be able to un.
Whoopsies. Although I will say.
Contemplate him.
I will say apparently he based that voice off of some recordings of, was it a similar oil baron or something? It was some wealthy character from the time period that they were like studying as they were making the movie. So he didn't pull the voice out of his ass. It is based on something.
I also think that Daniel may have created that character as he got more successful and has basically gotten stuck into it.
Oh, you mean the
like
Plainview.
Daniel Plainview, not DDL, right? But we don't hear him before he's an oil man, so it's kind of difficult.
He definitely has very polished pitch, like the sales pitch, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he commands a room. He speaks well. He speaks eloquently. He enunciates
very
as he
clearly.
Said.
Yeah,
I think it's a character because it is a bit too cartoony to be. Reasonable.
Yeah, and that was the other, that's what kind of helped me to get back into it. I'm like, okay, he doesn't speak like everyone else in the world, but that could just be part of the story that like everyone kind of, you know, that's what makes him such an enigmatic and interesting character, even for the people in the movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. And the only time he has to be on is when he's around anyone else.
Right.
Whereas Eli is kind of, you know, he does his sermon voice, and he has a very clear delineation his, you know, get out, spirit, and his quiet, soft-spoken, like Eli normal person voice. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I thought that was so interesting watching Paul Dano.
Is that Eli's actor?
Yes.
Yes.
With his, like, because this is one of his first breakout roles, I think, right? Or
no idea.
Or the breakout role. He was pretty young. I forget exactly how old he was, but you can tell that he's like, he's got that sort of like young man, teenager, still kind of like a weak voice, but he's doing an impression of these like bombastic, fiery, you know, Southern preachers, get out, devil, you know, like, and it's like, but he doesn't have that grit in his voice. He's like, get out, devil.
But he takes it up. He takes it up into his, like, the back of his throat and he's, get out.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's what he can do.
Yeah, and that's just as terrifying. So.
But it's authentic.
It works. It works.
Exactly.
But it,
exactly.
Like, I love that sort of, it's not a juxtaposition, but just kind of seeing that familiar, fiery preacher voice come out of this, like, diminutive little weak person.
And we've seen him the whole time at the Sunday farm. Oh, thank you so much for coming to our farm. Would you like some goats?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. That's why that scene is so powerful the first time you see it. Yeah, for sure.
It really hits hard.
Back to HW.
Okay. Mm.
There's a lot of parenting stuff. And a lot of conflicts are set up right early. Remember, Daniel sees a competitor, another oil man at the train station.
That's right.
And that's the guy that's like, he sets up this conflict between Daniel and HW right away. He's saying, don't get hosed. Don't get swindled, boy. You could get, you make sure your dad's paying you.
If you want it, I'll go like a lawyer. I'll be a lawyer and make sure you get half of what your dad makes.
To the audience, it's kind of like emphasizing this whole, this kid's getting exploited.
I also really like that scene because the other oil man knew another oil man. You know, they both know what an oil man is like.
Yeah, yeah.
And they could just see right through each other.
Yeah, regular family business. Yeah, they're looking at each other's like strategies.
Yeah.
And tactics.
Like, ha, 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 yes. He understands that HW is a pawn and knows basically Daniel's character just from his business choices. So it's a very short scene and comes at the right time because I don't think at that point in the film we really had a good inclination about what kind of actual evil person Daniel is. Mm-hmm. And then we get this sort of caricature of what the audience might know an oil man is like. You know, I got a 10-gallon hat and I'm from Texas and we're all, right? And you go, okay, this is an oil man. You know immediately.
This is a normal person.
This is a normal evil tycoon person. And he's talking to Daniel as an equal and also saying to HW, like, I've got to be a lawyer for you because you're going to get screwed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so sees what HW is. And then that scene is over and now he's back to swindling, I think. Mm-hmm. So that was quite an interesting little turning point there.
There's another little thing where, like, we never really see him doing real parenting to HW. Mm. When they're sitting, I believe it's at a campfire, and HW tells Daniel that little girl's father beats her if she doesn't pray. Daniel doesn't impart any like a take on it.
Right.
He doesn't go, well, that's because
or
you don't have to worry about it or
he
doesn't do anything that. He just confirms like that's the smaller girl. And that's it. He doesn't do any real parenting. And then he has this weird
HW almost like a coworker or like a, you know, underling or something. He doesn't like
This is my business.
He's not
associate.
Parenting per se.
No.
He's directing, sure.
But on the other hand, when the Derrick is burning down, he runs in to save HW.
I wanted to mention that as well. It was really quite pointed that, oh no, HW. And I thought that was interesting for his character.
Because that really, you could argue, like, they could have shown it the other way. If you're thinking, like, he only cares about HW insofar as he can help his business. Mm-hmm. Right now, his business is burning down. So they could have shown him not caring anything about HW and just trying to save the well. And he does make efforts to do that. But his first thing was to go and save HW. And then once he figures out HW's, you know, he's out of danger, he's has some long-term damage, but he's out of danger now, then he runs back to save the Derrick.
Mm-hmm. But this is what's so damning to me about that. And this is why I love this movie, because it makes you ask these questions. At first, you're kind of like, oh, he does care about HW. He's running. He's running to save his son, you know? And he goes and gets him out of danger. And then he's like, okay, I got work to do. So even at that point when he like leaves him and he's like, and HW's like, don't leave. And he's just like, hold him down. You're like, okay, you know, he has to stop.
It's justifiable. It's defensible.
He has to stop the Derrick. But once the Derrick falls, or
he realizes this means there's an ocean of oil under our feet, it's only his partner who goes, hey, how's HW?
Yeah. And
not only that,
he stays there all night looking at the oil. He doesn't go back. So it's like if he did actually care about HW, he would not only care about his physical safety, he would care about his emotional well-being. He wouldn't want to assure him that he's there, you know, but he doesn't care about that. He literally only cares about HW's physical safety because he is a tool for him.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he even knew that he was deaf already. So then he's like, he's not even going to really be used to me after this, so...
Yeah.
And he also ghosts him in such a cold way, right? He doesn't give him a talk. He just goes, I'll be right back. And then the kid's yelling for him, and he just pretends he doesn't hear him and eyes front and walks to his vehicle.
I saw someone describe that scene as a predator transfixed by his prey, because all he cares about is oil, and all he wants is more of this blood to suck out of the earth like a vampire. And so he's just like transfixed, and he can't leave until they actually put out the fire. And then at that point, then he gets up and walks away. It's like he's in a trance.
So why does he have this savior complex with Abel's daughter, where he buys her a new dress and says there's no more hitting?
Like, that remains kind of confusing to me.
There was a really awkward look between...
When Abel's eating, and then he looks across the table like, you son of a bitch.
Fucking asshole.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't... That actor nailed that glare. Holy.
Oh, I felt that. It was unpleasant. Yeah.
I couldn't help but think while watching the movie that Daniel had some sort of weird designs for her. If she like he was waiting, he wanted to take care of her, and then when she got older, maybe he would try and take her for himself.
Well, she ends up with HW. Is that what his plan was?
And maybe that's why he's extra mad at HW. I don't know,
because HW ran off
with her. He married her. Yeah,
yeah. But,
so,
but they didn't,
I don't,
they didn't
I don't
get
know
married
if that's...
and stay with Daniel. They left.
Yeah, I'm not going to defend that super hard, because I don't think the movie is like really clear with that. But it remains kind of confusing why he was so obsessed with protecting her from her dad.
Mm. I don't know. I think it's just more power plays. Power
I think
games.
It might be that as well. Like, he
exerting
just wanted to
power over the Sunday family, who he kind of detests on every level.
Right, right. Like, he to him, Abel is he was taken advantage of. To him, Abel is a weakling and
he's like
worthless.
The worst person. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, if you, the worthless, weak person that I exploited, are trying to get some kind of power, it's like, no, you're worth nothing.
Abel's caught in the middle between Eli and Daniel. Hey, he just gets stomped
on
by everybody.
He's already lost Paul, too. Yeah. Paul ran off.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so interesting how when Daniel beats down Eli, the next scene is Eli beating down his dad. It's just like the cycle of violence, but it's not generational per se, or it's an opposite direction that it usually is. That was just so interesting. And it was also a great scene because it revealed to us that Eli is not this sort of like, you know, a benevolent preacher person. Like, he may believe in God or whatever, but at the end of the day, he's as selfish and silly and narcissistic as, you know, his faith is giving him nothing in terms of positive personality traits, is what I'm trying to say.
He's using his faith to get more power.
Right.
Like, Daniel's using his money to get more power. Yeah. And even if that means that Eli's going to beat his own father, that's not a morally righteous character at all.
Yeah.
Everybody in this movie's awful.
It's
a very brutal movie.
I want to say that normally that really bothers me. Normally I need to have some sort of good character in the show.
I don't, absolutely not. I prefer them all to be like this. I don't know if you guys have seen Burn After Reading.
Oh, I wanted to do that this week.
Okay.
or last week. Anyway,
so you like spoilers.
You like Nightcrawler, Casino.
I like Casino, yes. I like movies where everyone is unhappy Girls. The entire time. I don't think I've seen that.
I think I forgive. So like I do prefer for movies to have some sort of character that you can root for a little bit. Mm. But when there aren't those characters, if the movie is so strong in all these other areas, like there are really, really, really strong themes and the cinematography is good and the acting is good and the writing is good and the music is good. We haven't even talked about that. Then I'm like, all right.
I was
engaged. The
you
whole
hate
time.
To see any evil character be glorified.
Exactly.
Oh,
and I think this movie
enrages Riley more than a Scarface poster.
Yes.
I think a glorified evil character is very bad.
Down.
No one in this movie looks good.
No.
They are not glorified.
Which is why I love it.
Very obviously evil.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that kind of comes back to the he's not showing off his wealth. You know, we don't see him be really wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
We just see him be rather powerful.
Yeah.
And so it's not glorifying wealth in any way. It's just sort of like another HW. It's another tool for his toolbox of mayhem.
And I think that another thing that I appreciate about this movie is that even though he is bad, everyone's bad, there is enough space while watching the movie to entertain these kind of morally gray questions of like, oh, maybe he does care about HW. Oh, maybe he was justified in whatever, blah, blah, blah.
He's manipulating you as well.
Yeah. And like you are trying to kind of like think about, okay, which one's better, you know, him or Eli or whatever.
Well, you know, this town's kind of poor. Maybe they
maybe he is
like
doing some good
school.
Yeah.
Well, that's the
road.
Thing because they,
but at the
like,
end,
if this happened today, if anyone, these questions still get asked today, right? Like, oh, should we let this development go through or something like that? And there's always a lot of skepticism. And obviously people are in it for their own selfish reasons. And that's true in this movie. But the people, yes, they're skeptical, but they really do have a lot to gain. They really, really have a lot to gain. Like they're like destitute. Like the shack that the Sunday family lives in, it's like a two room.
And all they have to eat is goat's milk and maybe some potatoes.
Yeah, or you can have like work to do. You know, like you can go and work on this oil rig.
That's right.
They needed it more than I think we do in modern era. We're kind of on a higher level of global infrastructure.
We're just better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, screw those 1900.
So I mentioned the music briefly there. I wanted to bring it up because I feel like it does so much for the vibe. Of the movie.
One of the Radiohead peoples.
Yeah, Johnny Greenwood.
Really?
The guitarist for Radiohead did the score.
He's done a few.
He's
done a few PTA movies, I think.
Yeah.
Interesting, like,
percussion a lot of the time.
Signatures.
Oh, it was so good.
And, like, counterpoint, and it was.
And I love how, like,
at
eclectic.
The perfect time.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. In an early scene, he brings in these, like, horror style, like, plucky strings, and it's like. Dun, 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 dun.
The opening shot of the movie is just a landscape with like a wall, like a brick wall of music.
It's like a horror thing.
Yeah, you're just looking at mountains.
Yeah.
And then you get title, and then you get hard cut, everything silent, man in hole.
Right. And there are times in the movie where they have this like music and then it cuts out completely and we get some silence and then like another scene happens and as it builds up, we get these like crazy chaotic strings, but they're different from the other chaotic strings.
This movie is so intense.
Yeah.
And the sonic design of it is a huge part of the intensity.
Yeah.
And there's some like that structure and that ebb and flow of the scenes.
And the long shots and long scenes.
You get
too.
A long, like quiet, close scene where the tension is rising but the music's not there and then right at the end of it you're like, okay, well I understand where this is going in the plot now, and then we have this hard cut wide shot, big music, action, and they're like building the derrick and it's like activity and the fast-paced cuts, and so it's like
there's a number of like little montages that happen, and I feel like they that not only do they tell us that time is passing, but they set the mood so perfectly.
And they're interspersed, and so it's kind of like, yeah, this has been dragging a little bit now. I'm relaxed, and I'm enjoying the dialogue, and then yeah. It's like, okay, well, stuff still has to happen, so let's get to work. And then right. It's up and down, and it's, yeah, it's good.
I think exactly. It's time for nitpicks and hitpicks, guys.
I agree.
Okay.
Nitpicks.
I'm just going to take, this is not a nitpick or hitpick. I'm just going to take this opportunity to put in a point that I forgot to say earlier, which is with HW, again, he shows affection to HW, but only when it has to do with the oil.
Yes.
He finds some oil, gets it on his shoe, and then he gets praise from
yes.
from dad.
We
yes.
did it, HW. He's more like, found yeah. the oil.
He's yeah. more like a dog. He's yeah. like a dog to him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I haven't said this earlier, but it seems unclear. People on the internet seem to have different ideas, but I think HW, some people seem to think it stands for human worker. So
I don't know.
That's what I've seen multiple people say that's what it stands for. It wasn't in the IMDb trivia, so I don't know.
I don't know if the symbolism would be that blatant.
But people were talking about that as if it's fact. So maybe at some point PTI said that, but I'm not sure.
Maybe it's in the book.
Well, the book is. This is loosely based on the book, so I don't know.
Okay, yeah, well,
but there is a father and son in the book. I think his name's Bunny in the book, so I don't.
That's worse than HW.
His name is just the father's name. It's a different name, but it's father's name Junior, and then Bunny is his nickname.
Yeah, if Daniel wanted to give the son even more family man purposeness, then I'm sure he would have picked maybe a religious connotation name or something that played to his audience.
Right.
Maybe HW is just so bland that people can't identify with it. Because, you know, like,
or maybe it
Daniel.
Sounds upper class.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that too. Sounds important. Daniel, Abraham, you know, all of those are like Bible names, right? And maybe somebody's from a different religion and
I also
can't
saw,
be exploited.
I also saw someone else saying that HW was like a representation of like Yahweh, because in Hebrew it's just W or YHWH.
Sounds like a reach.
YHW. Yeah, it sounds like a reach too, but you just saying that now made me think of I read that, but.
A bit of a reach there, but.
I doubt that that's the case.
Hit pick.
Wait. Oh. In regards to what we were saying earlier, I just saw this person. Apparently PTA did a Reddit AMA when Phantom Thread released. Mm-hmm. And someone asked him, did Daniel Plainview ever truly love HW, or was it always just a facade? And PTA said, for sure he loved him. For sure, for sure. Don't you think? Question mark. He just didn't know what to do when HW grew into his own man.
Interesting.
I disagree. I think PTA is a weirdo, and he doesn't even understand what he wrote.
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Here's a hit pick. One of the best shots is when, at the beginning, they're on the train, Daniel and the baby, and then the baby reaches up and touches his mustache. That's just like, so lucky you got that shot.
Yeah.
You can't direct a
it
baby.
It was a good shot, yeah.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I fully believed that I was just witnessing Daniel Plainview and this baby at that moment. Like, I was fully immersed.
No acting.
There was no fourth wall. No. Does that make sense?
Yes. Sure.
You
sure.
were on the train.
Do you guys have nitpicks and hitpicks? Let's hear them.
I don't know what these are.
Didn't brief him.
Just little. I didn't tell him about the hitpicks and nitpicks. It's just little things in the movie that you were like, oh, that's pretty cool, or oh, that bugged me. But it's not like a big discussion. It's not a big point of discussion.
I'll give you a nitpick.
I got a hitpick.
This is another baby-related one. When they first strike oil, when HW's dad's still alive, he puts a little Simba kind of like oil mark on the kid's forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, cool, but no one would ever do that. Not because it's like gross to put oil on your baby's head, which it is, but like that would be instantly everywhere, especially the baby's eyes. Babies,
yes.
He would immediately touch it with his hands, and his hands would go in his mouth and his eyes. Parent would ever freaking do that.
It's not even his kid, though.
No, it is. At that point in the movie.
At that point, he's adopting
it. It's HW's dad that.
It's HW's dad that does that.
All right, yeah.
I saw that described as another sort of way to have the oil being a stand-in or a symbol for blood, because like it's like the kid is being like baptized or whatever. I forget what tradition that is where you put a little blood on
goats.
Is it goat's blood?
I don't know.
But they're like, we're like, you know, blessing the child with the sacred liquid.
The sacrament.
Yeah.
Cool.
Hit pick for me early on is I wrote, what a sense of control with the camera. So like when Paul first walks in, The camera's slightly behind him. We can kind of see the side of his face, but Paul walks in, he introduces himself to Daniel, and the camera stays behind him so that we can see, and it slowly reveals Daniel in the room with his associate. I forget his name, but he's played by Kieran Hines. It's been a lot of stuff. Anyways, so we stay framing them until Paul says, please don't think I'm stupid, or please don't assume that I'm stupid or something.
That's right.
And then at that point, Daniel's like, oh, well, and he like reclines, and the camera then turns to show us Paul's full face. And I was like, this is not only one whole shot for this whole thing, which is nice to see. It felt so controlled, and it felt really thematic, because only when Paul is like telling him, he's like, listen, I'm not one of these fake people that you hate. You know, I'm intelligent. We're peers. Okay. I'm here. We're here to do a deal. Okay.
Yeah.
And at that point, the camera shows us his face. He's an individual. He's not an animal, as Daniel sees every other human in the universe.
They do this a similar thing in other scenes as well. Like when they're at the dinner table, when he's first trying to buy the ranch, he's talking to Abel. Plainview's talking to Abel the whole time. And then when finally Eli commands his attention, that's the only time it goes from a wide shot to now close ups.
Yeah.
And it's just like Eli's face, Daniel's face, back and forth.
Yeah.
And then it's, on the realm of long shots, the scene where Eli is taking the ghost out of the woman's arthritis, Plainview's walking up toward the church, and you actually already hear Eli giving this sermon. Mm-hmm. And then we follow Daniel in, and he sits down, and then the camera goes over, and Eli takes over the scene. But they were already shooting. He was already delivering that monologue before our character even entered.
Right.
It's awesome.
Very, very good.
A lot of this stuff was ad-lib, from what I understand. So I feel like I could tell that when Paul was like Paul Dano was like ranting during that whole like sequence. It's like some of the stuff he says, we were just like, that was not scripted. You just kind of said what came into your head.
Yeah. I mean, he's pretending to be a pastor almost, yeah. You know,
he probably prepared.
He's probably 12, 15. I don't know how old.
He's a small child. He was abandoned. And apparently that whole speech that Plainview gives to the town when he's trying to like convince them to get on board.
When they're in the barn at night.
That whole speech about like the roads and the education and blah, blah, blah.
So road that was all ad-lib. Church?
What?
Yeah, that was all ad-lib.
That was crazy.
Really good.
Yeah. And I remember reading that PTA and DDL like worked together. Like PTA wrote the script, but then during the pre-production process and during production as well, they were like both kind of working together on the character, and PDA would let him like ad lib this stuff. And so, and you can feel it. I feel like a lot of the scenes are just too chaotic to be actually fully scripted.
Mm.
You can tell that like, okay, they just kind of let him go with this, like let DDL go with it. You're just like, especially like the scene where he's like trying to intimidate those other guys at their table.
Yeah.
Like that was,
he was drunk before they went to lunch. He was sloshed.
Yeah.
He had just had his whiskey. Yeah, no, that was very ranty. And
for sure.
He was gone.
Yeah.
That was great.
I loved it.
I think for me, there's a bunch of like little setups and payoffs with foreshadowing and stuff like that. I can't really remember any, but there was one scene, I think, when Daniel finally realizes and knows in his heart that his not brother isn't actually his brother.
Mm.
I think, what are they? Must be at a brothel or something like that. We have an extreme.
Oh, he's at, oh, yeah. They're at the beach, and he says,
No. Oh, you're talking about when his.
It's a really short
Henry
scene.
Comes up to borrow money from him, and he hates him, and he knows.
Well, but
can I borrow some money? And Daniel's also drunk because they're obviously out having fun, but he's like, look at this, with no dialogue, look at this animal. He's laughing and carrying on, making a fool of himself, and also asking me for money. this is not my brother, and it's just silent, and you just know that he knows.
Actually,
I think that's like confirming it. I think that scene like is confirming it, but the moment I think he says like Peachtree Island when they're on the beach and he's
what
like,
what was the name of the farm beside the hill house?
I think he asked him
that was after, but when they're at the beach and they're swimming.
We'll take you to the dance.
Yeah, we'll take them to the dance at Peachtree Island, and Henry is just kind of like, oh yeah. And then like it's very, very distinct. They're just kind of like smiling and talking about plans and blah, blah, blah. And as soon as he says that Peachtree Island and Henry reacts, it's like a huge shift.
He's
and Daniel's just like,
am I that bad at jokes?
Yeah,
you should have laughed at that.
And it just, the camera just stays on him for like 30 seconds. And he's just like looking at him and like looking down and like looking back at him. And he's just like serious. And then it cuts to the club.
Yeah. And that's when it's like, I've made up my mind that I hate you.
Yeah.
And I know you're not related to me.
And then I actually have a hit pick when he's actually confronting him, and then Henry's telling his story about how he did this whole plan, and he's telling it with like this, all this remorse on his face, and it looks like, you know, maybe he can talk his way out of this. And then it cuts back. You know, we're watching him deliver this speech, and we're probably mirroring the same face that he has on, like remorse. And then but actually the shot reverses to Daniel, and he's incensed. He's just like, every word just makes him more angry.
Yeah.
It's awesome. His face is so red.
Okay.
We immediately get like a hard cut to him digging a hole. It's just excellent.
I love that scene because it shows that even if, like, it shows his rage. And I think that's like the biggest block that he has to his own success is he can't control his rage. Like, he's in these talks with I forget who it is, but the guy's not from Union Oil, Standard Oil.
I'm gonna come into your house and slit your throat.
Yeah, I'll come and cut your throat. He's like, what did you say? Because it was just such a weird thing to say. It's like, it's showing that he's completely off his rocker.
He's irrational. He's like, you're not mad at me.
Yeah. And if he was more controlled, and if he was like, I love that he can barely, it's like he barely manages to manipulate people because the slightest thing is triggering to him and he wants to rip people's heads off.
He had just lost HW. I think the scene before HW gets shipped off on the train.
Yeah.
And then these people are coming there and he just couldn't business anymore.
Yeah.
He's like hyper vigilant.
Yeah.
He's like looking for like any perceived slight about anyone who could be perceived to be talking about this move that he just did with HW, because he's so guilty.
I think that him losing HW and people realizing that he might be to blame for this is like an affront to his character. Or it's destroyed his personal, his public perception.
That's right, because he's like, well, what would I do if I wasn't making money? Well, you could take care of your son. You're saying I'm not taking care of my son.
Yeah. So you know what?
Like, now it's an attack on his character.
Exactly. I'm taking it back. He does care about HW, but it's like, it's an unhealthy type of love. It's the type of love in like a romantic relationship where it's like, you guys need to break up. This is not healthy, but they love each other too much, or they're infatuated with each other, but it's not like real love. You know, they don't actually know how to take care of each other and what you should be doing in a relationship. It's like that. He feels guilty that he abandoned his child, which is why it's hard for him to say that in that scene. He's like, at first he's just like, I've abandoned my child, and he's like, you abandoned your child. He doesn't want to scream it, and then
he says,
eventually,
I've abandoned my boy. That's the authentic part of it.
Yeah.
He comes around to believing it's true, and not just
So
he's not just doing it for his own to advance his pipeline.
It's clear he has real feelings.
That came from him.
Hit pick. Such an amazing edit. Back to the scene where they're swimming at the beach. He goes back and he swims. The scene ends with him getting back in the water. He's kind of like floating there, and the waves surge, and then it cuts to him kind of under the water, but you only see part of his body. You see the hand. The hand like wipes across the screen, the frame, and then they cut to the bar that he was in, and then when they're at the bar, there's someone standing really close to the camera, who's walking across the frame, so in the same motion as the hand was. So it's just this really sick match frame in motion from like his hand being underwater to someone walking across the lens, and it's just amazing. It's stupid to describe this verbally, but go back to that scene,
I can't remember the end
of that scene, and watch it, and you'll be like, holy, that is a crazy edit.
Whoa.
Very good.
I'm giving this movie extra points.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 9.5. Hit pick. I love the way characters are so often covered with oil, because it really makes it seem like a horror movie, but the oil, like it's not blood, it's oil. But it's almost like every time they're covered with oil, something horrible is happening, or like, you know, there's a disaster, or
the one that stood out to me was when they're back at the Sunday ranch at dinner time after Eli was slapped around and put in the oil pit, and he's at dinner still covered in oil.
Yeah
He did not clean up at all,
right?
And he's sitting there, he looks so dejected, he's just like out of it.
Yeah, and it's a great image because the rest of the family is clean and he's sitting there at the table,
head of the table, not eating,
grimy,
just sort of thousand yard stare.
Yeah. Love it.
Hit pick. I never noticed this before. There's a shot where like this train car arrives and the door is open, and the camera's inside the train cars, the door's open, and whoever's receiving the train car goes, hey, get out of here, like talking to some like hobos who stowed away. And then the next shot is of Henry. So Henry was one of those hobos who stowed away on the train. Like, that's how like destitute he was.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
I missed that.
I only saw that this time.
Interesting.
Hit pick in the baptism scene. I just love how after the whole, like, he's like, I've abandoned my child, and blah, blah, blah. And at the end, like, it's over now. And he's like, do you want the blood? And he's like, I want the blood. He's like,
give me the blood, Eli.
Give me the blood.
Yeah, do you accept the Lord or whatever? He's like, yes, I do.
Yeah, the yes, I do. Yeah. So I actually think I thought of you when that happened.
Yes, yes, let's do it. All right.
All right, you've officially ruined this movie for me. Our main character is a cartoon character.
Hit pick the guy who dies on the job because they drop that spike on him. Mm. At this point in the movie, you've seen people die in the wells like three different times. They show him. He's at the bottom, wading in oil with a lit cigarette in his mouth. And you're like, this is not going to end well. But not because of that. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, for sure. That's great. With misdirection.
And they're brutal, too. The deaths, like, you feel them. They don't shy away from that. And they come randomly, just like any workplace
accident.
They're
all very visceral.
They're very visceral, and they're unexpected and random, just like any workplace accident. And and they're felt by this small town. It's like, it's bad. It hurts. This movie is awful.
Yeah. But I think it's also really hard to watch because you know that they died because of like a stupid little mistake. It's not even like, oh, whoops, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time or something. It was like someone's pulling a rope and then they slip and it goes and now someone's dead. It's like, I mean, it's so brutal.
It's all these hard-won best practices of engineering. Yeah. Like, okay, when you build this, you got to build it like that or otherwise it's going to snap off and kill your friend.
Right. And that's why this is so fascinating because this is when they were figuring out all this stuff. Like, this is the first time. Like, it's the oil rush.
This is the OSHA paid in blood. Rules, right?
Oh yeah, OSHA. Yeah, this is
before OSHA. This is what wrote
pre-OSHA.
Wrote that. Yeah,
yeah.
Let your coworkers know when you're down the hole and wear a visi vest. They lockout tags.
They don't have the notices. They don't have the memos yet.
My final nitpick: after HW loses his hearing, Daniels has to talk to him so many times. Like, God, just write the kid a note. Write it down. He can't hear
I know.
You.
That's Fuck. So, it's so frustrating. He keeps trying to like just talk to him. And I think...
I don't think he understands.
Well, I think... I appreciated that as sort of a characterization of this, like, old-timey flavor of masculinity, where it's just like, okay, you had an accident and you can't hear, but I'm telling you something. Do you understand?
Walk it off,
like,
big guy.
Yeah, you're just like, you can deal with it now. It's just like, you don't need special schooling or special teachers. You can... he's my boy. He'll get better,
yes,
you know?
Yes, this is like the English... idea of, oh, you're from somewhere else and don't speak English? I'll just speak louder then.
You must
it's
be stupid.
It's in there somewhere.
In there somewhere.
It's in there somewhere. You must have the King's English in you somewhere.
You stop that misbehaving and actually hear me. I mean, it's there's not like...
All right, stop being silly now.
Yes, stop it. Stop it.
We shall. We got to wrap it up. Let's move on to Now Playing.
Made that jingle, the jingle.
I haven't been watching anything, but we wanted to talk about the Mario trailer, the Chris Pratt Mario voice.
It's funny.
Just want Charlie Day. Just want to hear Luigi. That's
I understand.
All I care about.
Yeah, yeah, that was kind of funny that they.
I need it.
Like it's often the case with these teasers that they won't give like away what they know people really want to hear, which is at this point we want to hear Chris Pratt as Mario. That's the meme.
Yeah.
But it's still very very frustrating because it almost seems like they're hiding it. It's like if they told us now this far out from the release of the movie what the voice was, it's almost like they're blowing their load too early.
Well,
you know?
They've done
like,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been so many. There, it's always Sunny in Philadelphia edits. Of Luigi.
Oh, really? After he was cast.
After he was cast, yeah. And I just hope it's that. That's all I can hope for. But you've finally seen the trailer now. I don't know.
I skimmed.
What did you think of Chris Pratt's Mario?
That was very off-putting. I don't know. Maybe they tried. Like, here's a charitable rating. Maybe they actually tried. They're like, all right, let's see what it's like if a whole movie where the main character talks... like what we've heard in the video games, because it's fun enough for him to be like, wahoo, let's go, when he talks every like hour for one line, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
But when it's like full dialogue and he has to like explain something or say a whole paragraph,
yeah.
Do you really want to hear that?
But I mean, his original voice actor is like quite a good voice actor, right? He just didn't do jumping and other sounds.
Charles Martinet?
That's the guy.
Yeah.
Right?
But did he ever have to do the Mario voice for more than
for a whole thing?
A quip?
Yeah. So,
I mean, this is the issue, is that when you're designing sounds for games, and especially something in that era, you don't want it to be super irritating. You can't have very many sounds because of storage space limitations. And if you're the player and it plays a wahoo every single time you jump, the player is going to be hearing that like 200,000 times during their star extravaganza, right?
So I think it's understandable why they didn't go with him for this movie.
But you're not going to be doing that type of voice the whole time. Like, I'm sure he's got more range.
What do you think would have been ideal?
So there are various clips of Charles Martinet doing Mario at like conventions you know, on a panel or something, and he like there's clips of him talking at extended lengths. In that voice, it gets irritating. You can't listen to a whole movie if he's like, "Well, I think we should go to the Mushroom Kingdom." And it's like, okay, all right, stop. I think
that's reasonable.
Yeah.
I certainly think that's reasonable. I think he apparently, it does have a guest appearance.
Oh, sure. Yeah. At least.
But
I think that they cast Chris Pratt because he's done the Lego movie.
Voice actors.
He did, what was the other thing he did?
I don't care.
Guardians of the Galaxy?
Well, no, there was another one that
Was he the raccoon?
He was in a cast and a voice.
No, that's Bradley Cooper.
Chris Pratt did another big voice for a movie. I forget. Anyways, obviously, Chris Pratt... What did you say?
It just, like, caught me that he was joking.
I'm sorry. James doesn't know me very well.
They cast Chris Pratt because he's bankable, you know, like as much scandal as he's, you know, got into on Twitter. Most people still love Chris Pratt, and they see his name on a thing. They're going to appreciate it, and they're going to recognize his voice as like, oh, that's the guy.
But it's a cartoon. Like, don't hire Hollywood actors. Hire voice actors who can do
voice
Mario would have enough pull, right? To like, it's a lot. It's a Mario movie. That's enough to make me want to go.
Yeah, I'm not going to be like, new IP.
It's a Mario movie. And it's Chris Pratt. Yeah, I'm in now. I was on the fence. Like, I feel like it's enough.
What I wanted to talk to you about, it because you're a voice actor, and I work on the other side of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, I'm sympathetic to. You know, a lot of people in the industry talk about this a lot, about how frustrating it is to be a professional voice actor and, you know, work on these series. Like, My Little Pony is a great example. They completely recast. Some of them might have gotten smaller roles, but they completely recast the main characters for My Little Pony when they did the My Little Pony movie on Netflix.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously the industry voice actors were upset about this. And I'm totally sympathetic to that. However, I understand that studios, you know, they're making these movies. They don't care about character authenticity. They don't care about this stuff. So, like, obviously, it's going to make sense that they're going to go and cast well-known actors. And you say that, like, okay, Chris Pratt isn't a voice actor. You know, it's like you can't see his face, so who cares? But people see the names on the poster.
Well, I mean,
they hear about it in the news.
Yeah.
So it's like there's obviously. Explanation for it beyond just like, well, no, the explanation is greed, but I guess I'm saying that like it's not something that you can criticize. Like, you can, it's just an element of the system.
I mean, is this where we are now? Do we just accept the system that we're under? I think we kind of have to.
I think we can, but like, it just seems like futile to me to like post on social media about the fact that how ridiculous it is that they're not using the original cast.
Oh, yeah.
When it's like, A, most people who are seeing this movie, like, if anyone, well, it's actually funny. Most people I see online talking about, like, Charles Martinet or whatever are like, yeah, I can understand how it would be annoying to listen to him doing Mario for a full movie, you know? But for other scenarios like this My Little Pony thing, like, people are complaining about it on Twitter, but at the same time, we know that most people are going to go see the movie regardless. Mm. So you can blame the studios, you can blame the public, but when the problem is of that vast of a nature, you starting a petition or starting a social media campaign or whatever to raise awareness about how shitty this is, it's just not going to do anything.
You know what people should do? And maybe they do this. You can tell me. Do they do like a almost like a fan edit? Like, if you were the voice actor who was like, no, they shouldn't have got Chris Pratt. They should have done it exactly this way. Nothing stops you, because it's animated, from just, like, cutting out his voice and putting in your voice and then just, like, uploading that to Pirate Bay and, like, fixed.
And then I'm gonna spend my life doing that now.
You know, yeah. Studios.
I want to make my own edit of a particular album that I really like, and yeah. just so I can listen to it. And I bet other fans of the band think similarly.
Yeah. I'm sure.
So I think we have seen examples of studios listening to fan feedback and changing course before. I mean, this happened with the Sonic animation thing where they were like, he looks horrible, and they actually they threw out what they had and started from scratch and redid the animation for that based on the public campaign, and the movie ended up being very successful. I thought it was kind of shit, but I'm not a Sonic fan. Anyways, we talked about that in the Sonic episode. Go check it out. But so we have seen studios react to this before, so maybe there is a way like this. That sounds interesting. I feel like if a voice actor who felt particularly slighted by one of these decisions did what you're describing, James, and it gained traction, it could be that the studio, I can see a world in which that has an effect.
That actually
doesn't have a monetary effect, though. They might not get anyone's attention. It just has like, well, that one's got a lot of cedars.
I think if he did a full read of that movie in the Mario voice and we heard what it sounded like, I mean, he'd get sued to all hell, but it might actually make a dent in the discussion where,
yeah, that's
this
what
is
saying.
What the fans wanted. Here's a cut of that. Here's the anti-Snyder cut.
Yeah, well, that's another great example, the Snyder cut.
Yeah.
We saw this with Morbius recently where the memes took off because people were posting about this movie constantly, but because it was a bad movie, Sony misunderstood. They thought the appetite was there. It was becoming a cult classic, so they re-released it in theaters. It bombed again.
Yeah, so, kind of amazing.
I think that studios are anxious and are eager to take advantage of viral trends when they're happening. So there is a chance that a grassroots campaign like this could lead to something. But I think on the whole, depending on the character, I think for someone like Mario, where the audience for this movie is not the nostalgic old people. The audience for this movie are the very, very young kids who haven't been hooked on Mario yet, and now Nintendo is going to be able to suck in a new audience segment.
And didn't get burned by the last Mario movie. I hope you two have seen that as well.
Wait, are you saying Mario?
I've seen clips.
Mario?
I'm a Mario guy.
Mario, sometimes the Canadian comes through.
I actually don't know what the right one is. I think it's Mario. Mario?
This depends on your accent.
I say Mario. I feel like most people. Anyways.
I say washing up liquid. I get enough flame for that.
I feel like you see some things with Batman or iconic characters like that. That aren't so like that, where they're like, where like the lore and the vibe is like a little bit more important.
Yeah.
Like people loved Kevin Conroy as Batman and Mark Hamill as Joker. So like studios kept bringing them back to voice characters, even in, different universes and like different timelines. So I think that fan sentiment plays a role there, but with something this big, it just doesn't, you're never going to win.
I don't think so either. The nice thing about me being the other side of the glass is I don't care who the voice actor is. I still get paid the same, right?
So right, of you being a producer.
We're part of the problem.
Yeah, yeah. It's your fault, really.
It really is. And I mean, I've done a lot of work with the Kreber family, who was some of the singing voices on My Little Pony as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they grow out of it, and you have to change the voice, it changes, but I think certain IPs are maybe more sensitive to
for sure.
having that identity, like Batman and the Joker. Like, those are kind of
characters
that have a certain kind of voice.
Right.
I don't know. It's the Mario 64...
Mario.
The Mario 64 version, if we can...
I wonder what the locality, like the differences between people in different areas saying Mario and Mario. Because where are you from originally?
Guys, we got to wrap this up.
I'm sorry.
I'm
from London, England, but I moved here when I was very young.
Wait, no, you're not.
Yes.
So are you?
I am technically an immigrant.
So nothing else survived except Mario.
Well, yeah. I mean, I got all the idiots.
I think they say Mario. I think that's an English thing.
I don't know. It depends on your locale.
Viewers, comment.
Yeah, you said locale so many times in this podcast.
I'm sorry.
I love the word.
Zeitgeist.
So, real quick, other than the Mario thing, what?
Why that word?
It's German. Just throw it in there.
Okay.
The British say Zietgeist.
Zietgeist. No, I was just, it was on the locale thing. Cotton wool, washing up liquid, all that sort of garbage.
Are we done? Or are we going to talk about other stuff?
Tweet at us. Ridiculous. Just movies. Wait.
I was just going to say Andor's really good. No one's, I've seen almost no one talking about it. Watch Andor, even if you're like, oh, the Star Wars shows suck. They did suck. This one does not. It almost feels like an HBO show sometimes in the Star Wars universe. It's great. Mm. That's it.
Okay. All right. Thanks for listening, guys. Thanks. You can tweet us at TJMPod. You can email us hello at theyrejustmovies.com. And next week, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Forgot to say it at the beginning. Sorry.
See you there inside our minds.
I think I did say it.
I think you did mention that. Yeah.
All right. Bye.
Love you.
Bye.